From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You listen, if you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want next time.
Everybody thinks show business, really, really, all
right,
life. He
doesn't crave.
What's with him? Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood, Hollywood.
This week on The Business, the special effects gurus, the brothers Strauss, on making Skyline for a thrifty $10 million. They wanted to prove themselves to the studios, but they found out they'd rather make their own films. Plus, we go behind closed doors at the American film market. But first, the Hollywood News banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I'm joined in the studio by my fellow banterer, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, I'm already sick of talking about NBC Universal. I don't know, as we're recording this, whether there will be a formal announcement. It may have happened by today. But it does look like Bob Greenblatt, formerly of Showtime, will be taking over NBC, both the broadcast network and the production company.
Which is the good news and the bad news. The good news is you have a good job. The bad news is you're running NBC.
Yes, that is really a challenge. I mean, Bob Greenblatt, just to give a little background, he ran Showtime, was considered hugely instrumental in putting Showtime in a great position with shows like Dexter, Weeds, The C Word, all of these, Nurse Jackie, these shows. He is considered a guy with taste. But before that, he was at Fox, and he did shows like Melrose
Place.
Where
he didn't have taste.
Melrose Place, 90210, draw your own conclusions. He worked on those as a younger executive. He's a very popular guy who's considered to have, as I said, great taste, great nurture of talent. The challenge of turning around NBC, I don't know. I mean, it's a broadcast network. The pace is much more demanding than Showtime. You know, you have to fill up night after night after night with programming. Terrible problems. They have very little on which to even promote new programming.
No, it's a little bit like turning around a Carnival cruise liner drifting off the coast of
Mexico.
Dead in the water and there's no hot food.
It's really
bad.
That describes
NBC.
It does. And you know, the one other thing that, you know, Greenblatt hasn't done is reality, which is nowadays an important part of a network lineup. So I think the town will really be watching. And in this case, I would say, very rare, John, you know, rooting for the guy.
Right. Well, and I think he's coming in with the bar set very low. So all he can do is kind of move up.
You can't fall off the floor.
Exactly.
Now, in terms of other news in the industry, SAG and AFTRA, Screen Actors Guild and the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, really a very quiet
and
deal.
Quick. A quick deal. Like quick 3 days of negotiations.
Early.
I mean, the last time, obviously, SAG and AFTRA not only were fighting between themselves, but went out on a very long and costly strike. I think what's interesting is that they got some wage increases, about 2%. They got some health and pension benefits that went up a little bit, but there were no huge creative issues that divided the two sides. And I think now it's going to turn out to see what the writers and the directors are going to do.
Directors are never a problem.
Okay. What the writers are going to do. The directors always roll over. You're right.
All of these guilds, especially the writers, would like more money from stuff that they do online, but they just don't have the weaponry to fight right now. What with the economy and the digital revolution, things are just too tough in Hollywood to fight over something where the income isn't even that clear yet.
I will say that that's not entirely true. I think that's what the companies want the guilds to believe. But, I mean, we were just talking about the NBC Universal Comcast deal. I mean, that's a multi-billion dollar deal.
Sure.
So clearly Comcast believes there's a future in this business.
Right.
They just don't want to share it like the other companies with the creative talent.
Well, I guess my point is that the guild members don't have the fire in the belly to have that fight either. You know, they are not fighting.
I think that's true. And there's so much unemployment in Hollywood that it's hard to get a lot of people who are out of work anyway to get rallied around getting out of work
and
for a longer
terrified,
period of time.
Yeah, about where their next check comes from. Yeah. Meanwhile, I don't know how the Writers Guild is going to deal with their labor issues, but I wonder how they'll deal with Jessica Alba.
And the young actress was quoted in an interview saying this: good actors never use the script unless it's amazing writing. All the good actors I've worked with, they all say whatever they want to say. And John August, who is a established screenwriter with some great credits on Tim Burton's movies, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Big Fish, took exception to this on his very popular screenwriting blog and
really?
Has set off, within the writers' circles, a great little firestorm with screenwriters rebelling against the actors who speak their words.
Did he have any choice words for Jessica?
I'll give you a couple of examples. You're saying your co-stars who delivered their lines as written are not good actors? Awkward, John August writes. Following your logic, you've never been in a movie with both good actors and amazing writing.
Which may be true. I don't know. I don't have her credits in my head right now.
And you're setting dangerous expectations. So if an aspiring actor wishes to be good, she should say whatever she wants to say. That's pretty terrible advice, John August says. So Jessica Alba, whatever her next movie is, I think the screenwriter is going to give her some very bad dialogue and just see how she does with it.
We'll watch for that. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Directors who can execute big, effects-driven movies are the kings of Hollywood these days, and that's a pretty exclusive club. Christopher Nolan, James Cameron, Michael Bay, and just a few more. Now a pair of visual effects gurus who have worked on movies like Avatar, Wolverine, and 300 are making a play to become part of that elite group. Brothers Greg and Colin Strauss, who own the visual effects house Hydraulix, are no different from many others in Hollywood. What they really want to do is direct. They took a shot at it in 2007 on AVPR, Aliens vs. Predator Requiem. It grossed about $130 million worldwide, but it was not what they wanted it to be. We're talking a 12% score on Rotten Tomatoes. So the brothers took matters into their own hands. Using their effects house, complete with lights, cameras, and software, Greg and Colin Strauss could make an event-type film at an independent price. The result is Skyline, which opened this past weekend.
Stephen Hawking, astrophysicist and arguably one of the smartest people on the planet, warned us about the possibility of aliens from outer space.
Hawking says that if extraterrestrials visit us,
Matt Holzman, executive producer of the business, sat down with the brothers Strauss, as they call themselves, to hear the backstory on their alien adventure.
So, Greg, was part of the decision to do this that your experience directing a studio film, the Aliens vs. Predator movie, was not everything you wanted it to be?
Well, I think one of the things that really impacted Colin and I was that even though the movie cost $40, it did over $130 in worldwide gross, $130 million. It wasn't really perceived as a success, even though financially it was. So Colin and I found ourselves in a situation where the phone wasn't exactly ringing off the hook with job offers for directing features. And we took a clubbing in the critical circles for – and a lot of those things were things that Colin and I didn't have control over. So we felt like we were catching the blame for other people's mistakes. And that's a really hard thing to try to come back from in this town. I call it the, you know, everyone knows about director's jail. This was our jailbreak.
Right. And you know, I read a couple of interviews that you guys did talking about your experience with the Alien versus Predator movie. And you both of you do talk about this kind of lack of control in that movie. You don't really say specifically what things were being controlled that you wanted to control. Can you be a little more specific about some of the things that you wanted to be able to say yes or no to?
You know, we got hired on a pitch, and systematically over the course of the summer, just about every key aspect of the pitch, the smart ideas that we were hired for got dismantled or removed from the script.
But are we talking about stories or characters or like effect scenes? Or
all the above. All the above. Whether it was character backstory or exact action set pieces or motivations or, you know, or even just key creative aspects to the biology of the creature. These were things that were tussled about quite a bit, and a lot of it got removed. And, you know, there's just so many politics, so many different agendas from – it's not just at the studio. It's also, you know, sometimes there's the writer working against you directly on these things. So at a point, Colin and I were, you know, we just had enough of it because it's not a good way of working, and it creates a lot of the – issues in movies that the fans sit there and complain about.
It's interesting, Colin, because the Alien vs. Predator movie was something around a $40 million movie. It doesn't seem like it's big enough to where people would be meddling on a micro level, but it sounds like they were.
Yeah, pretty much from every aspect. And then also, you're up there shooting a movie and like they wouldn't even tell us what the movie was rated. We didn't find out that it was rated R until we heard an interview from Tom Rothman at some red carpet event for some other movie. And he said, oh, yeah, it's hard R, but we could not get even an answer from anyone on the rating.
Meaning that you didn't know what you should be shooting towards?
The script was obviously R, and then they were having us shoot every scene because, you know, we had F-bombs all through the script, and the script was basically R-rated. So they would make us shoot the airplane version, they called it, for the movie. So we had to shoot every scene twice. And it was just – it was a huge – it was just a burden, and that was just one little thing.
It was more confusing. It wasn't that they wouldn't tell us. To clarify that, you would ask, you know, our intent is to do a hard R movie, but do you guys approve that? Line goes dead. And like that line goes dead. There's no answer on the other end.
Was
something that plagued us throughout. One of the problems was here's what we think is the kick-ass design for a creature. What do you guys think?
Now, and did they then give you enough rope to hang yourself with that 3 months later they came back and said, this is not what we want?
Well, it was there were a couple of those things, too. But, I mean, one of the big things was the actual design didn't get approved in time. So we were shooting scenes without the creature in it. It's like it didn't get approved till months later, which meant that the creature guys couldn't actually build it. We were being thrust into situations where the day that we had to shoot this big scene was the first time we'd ever seen the creature, and there were some things that we didn't like on it, and we didn't have the opportunity to correct it. You just had to shoot.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with the brothers Strauss, who co-directed and produced the new sci-fi thriller Skyline. Previously, they directed the 2007 Fox movie AVPR, Aliens vs. Predator Requiem. And they found that working for a studio was frustrating on many levels, including when it came to casting and character. Greg Strauss says they went about it differently on Skyline.
Now, one of the things that we really wanted to make sure of from story point and character point was, like, there's no scientist character who's actually explains what happens.
And Mr. Exposition.
Yeah, because that's one of the things that you'll get with a studio movie. There's always, like, we need some character who's the bridge to the common man, because basically the audience is stupid and someone's got to spoon feed them.
Right.
And you need to have a scientist with his eureka moment. And that was one of the first things we did, was to get rid of that. There's even a scene in the movie where they try to turn on the TV to see what's going on. And literally all the news channels are just empty news desks. You know, there's just no one there. And there's no one to give them an answer. And it's like, to us, that was a way more interesting story of a bunch of people like in this building with this great vantage point of like looking over all of Los Angeles, seeing everyone's gone. Like, I mean, and there's no answers.
So maybe one of the benefits that you have of a low budget is that you can break a format that the studios are wedded to because they're afraid to stray from it because it's worked in the past.
Exactly. We can take some risks with the script that the studios might not be willing to.
Did you ever consider, Colin, trying to get a really big name in the film?
We didn't need big name actors. We just needed good actors. And, you know, it's a little bit like the Roland Emmerich model, I guess, in a way. Like, there's no actor's face on 2012 posters or Day After Tomorrow. And I think one of the things we liked about it, too, was the fact that we could kill anyone off at any time. You know, if you have Tom Cruise on the poster, I'm not going to die. I mean, I think Will Smith in I Am Legend was about the only time a big actor that, you know, actually let himself die at the end
of
the
movie. After they reshot the ending three times, too. Yeah. I was going to say that the best example is DiCaprio in The Departed. That's like one of those shocking, oh my God, what do you mean they just killed him? Aside from that, to try to kill the guy that's on, you know,
on the poster, not easy.
And to try to kill the $20 million man is not an easy feat.
They pay $20 million, you want him there.
You don't want to kill him off in act one.
Right,
so.
Exactly. Where did you find the money for Skyline?
On the financing side, CAA helped us set up initially with some debt from a distribution partner. And then
explain what that means.
Basically, they agreed to distribute the movie in three foreign territories and loaned us some money against the movie. So
they were saying, we get the distribution, we'll loan you some money against that future distribution. But what did you have at that time to show these future distributors?
We had a treatment that Liam O'Donnell and Josh Cortez had written. Probably, I think the initial one was only three pages. And then we had a bunch of concept artwork, creature designs. It was a pretty small package, to be honest. So.
But you also had your reputation as guys who could do effects.
Yeah, so here's the guys that just finished Avatar 2012, and they're working on Iron Man 2, and Benjamin Button before that. And here's an alien invasion movie. Our agent at CAA had a commitment for a good sum of money in under an hour, which was like blew us away.
It seems like there's a business model here. I mean, is this like a business model?
Well, it's absolutely a business model. I mean, a big criticism we have of the process is that movie companies are, the director's the CEO, and they have to design and build a product. And they assemble, the studio supplies, like they're the investor, and you hire up an entire corporation worth of people, including full accounting departments and everything.
Right. Every time you make a movie.
And you only just start to get really good at the process.
And then you fire everybody.
The last few weeks, then you fire everyone. So they never really get good at integrating all this stuff. I mean, it would be analogous to us as a visual effects company not owning the network switches, the computers, or any of the software we use to make visual effects, and that I would have to go out and rent all of that gear every time a job comes in. We would be out of business.
But you sound you're making a case for the studio model of the 40s and 50s, where the studio was self-contained. All the editors worked on the lot. All the cameras were sitting on the lot.
We have to be, as a visual effects company, I have to be self-contained. It's the only way to be competitive. They seem to have an archaic model that I don't understand. The only reason that you could argue that they could afford it is because they're making so much money on the movie.
It doesn't matter.
But
no one else has to be efficient.
And our margins in the visual effects business, there's no way we could support such seemingly crazy business practices.
Well, let's go back to talking about your movie Skyline. Obviously, you've killed the studios here on budget because you've made a movie that looks like a studio effects action movie for really a tiny fraction of the cost. But will you have the budget to be able to market this movie to make it as successful as you want? I mean, because we both know movies are really two things, the movie and the marketing. They happen to be very separate, and one generally doesn't survive without the other. So can you find the budget to make this movie as successful as you would like it to be?
Yeah, in the case of Skyline, I think that's where the next level of partnership came involved. We independently developed it, produced it, finished the film, and then Relativity acquired it from us. And the great advantage working with Kavanaugh and Tucker over there is they bring the muscle on the marketing side.
And these are the guys in the company Relativity, which is an extremely well-funded distributor, film producer. Yeah. I'm guessing that the marketing is considerably more than the production cost of the film.
By magnitude.
I mean, that's an unavoidable situation to be in when the budget level is this low, because the baseline marketing P&A budgets that you need to get awareness with the American public, there's a certain threshold that below, we could just pick a number out of there, below like 20 million, you're not going to get to enough people.
Well, argue that with indie films, the way they have been traditionally marketed and the way they're successful without marketing budgets is word of mouth. But for a film that's going to appeal to a wider audience, you really do kind of have to open it big, because that's just how it's done.
This is only an indie in terms of the way it was developed and produced. From the point of acquisition to marketing and distribution, it's very much a big studio film.
You said earlier that this movie was kind of jailbreak for you because you weren't getting a ton of calls after you did the Aliens versus Predator movie. Are you getting the calls now, Colin?
Yeah, there's been a lot of buzz. There's been a lot of interesting stuff going on, and
the heat is on.
Yeah, but for us, we're not interested in doing another studio movie. I mean, to us, we have plans for another three movies that we want to keep doing in this new model, and we just want to find a good studio partner for distribution. But we want to just make the movies the way we want to make them, and then hand them a product. And that's kind of how we want to keep it going.
The brothers Strauss, Greg, and Colin are the co-directors of the indie CGI thriller with a big-budget studio look called Skyline. It started destroying humankind this past weekend, November 12th. Greg and Colin, thanks for talking with us.
Cool. Thank you very much.
It's been our pleasure.
Coming up after a short break, we go behind the scenes where deals are made at the American film market. Now you can find KCRW's The Business on Facebook, where you can post your comments or give us your ideas for the show. You're listening to The Business from KCRW and KCRW.com. For 1 week each fall, the American Film Market, or AFM, takes over Santa Monica. The Lowe's Hotel is converted into an office complex where film buyers and sellers from all over the world convene to wheel and deal, wine and dine, and exchange money in hopes of making a profit in the movie business. At the AFM, distributors look to buy films to release in their home territories from sellers with movies in various stages of production. One such seller is IM Global. In the last few years, that company has sold rights to high-profile movies like Paranormal Activity and Tom Ford's A Single Man. This year, the Indian entertainment conglomerate Reliance, famous for its billion-dollar investment in DreamWorks, bought a majority stake in IM Global, and the company has branched out beyond genre films and art house fare. IM Global had a team of 15 at the AFM, led by CEO Stuart Ford, a man with nearly 20 years in the business, including 8 at Miramax. To learn what goes on behind closed doors at the AFM, the business producer Darby Maloney spent a day shadowing this new power broker.
So I get to the Lowe's around 10:30 in the morning. It's the fourth day of the market. The first meeting I attend with Ford and his senior sales guys is with a French distribution company, Canal Plus. In the main room that they use for all these meetings, there's a huge flat-screen TV in the corner, a mini-fridge stocked with water and Coca-Cola in another corner. There's huge sliding glass doors looking out over the beach and the ocean and the Santa Monica Pier, and another set of glass doors looking out over the pool. The men are seated on couches and chairs, circled around a coffee table. There are some healthy snacks there, along with some cookies. And there's plenty of information about all the movies on IM Global's slate. A couple of marketing materials stand out, namely a thick hologram one sheet for a new hot 3D movie they're selling, Walking with Dinosaurs.
What about Your Little Baby?
A little dinosaur movie?
Your Little Dinosaur movie.
What do you think of a little dinosaur movie?
May I be really transparent and fully transparent? I thought...
Now, Walking with Dinosaurs is not a completed film. In fact, it won't even go into production until the end of the year. But that hasn't stopped it from being a big seller at the AFM. A few days before this meeting, IM Global and Reliance, along with the BBC, their partner on the movie, showed a short to prospective buyers of what the final film will look like 2.5 years from now. The buyer from the French company Canal Plus may not have been impressed by the presentation, but that doesn't mean the IM Global guys couldn't try to change his mind.
It seemed like when you told him that Walking with Dinosaurs was going to be sold out by the end of the day, you turned his mind.
Well, when you come to film markets like this, it's a competitive environment, and nobody wants to miss out. Plus, that's a project that, if it hits huge. So no one wants to be the person that passed on Walking with Dinosaurs, just as no one wanted to be the person who passed on Twilight. We've been sort of introducing that sense of fear into all of our discussions.
After that, a visit from a different French distribution company, TF1. Patrick Vinet is a veteran of this business, and he walks in casually, sucking on a lollipop, and joking that Ford was in his dream last night, both as an angel and a devil. The day before, Patrick had made a big offer to buy Walking with Dinosaurs for France, and Ford had been avoiding sealing the deal. After some friendly jibes, Ford levels with them.
Here's where we are. In terms of your offer, I'm Walking with Dinosaurs, and I'm telling you this very privately, I don't want it to leave this room. We're at a very advanced stage of negotiation with a US studio on the US deal, and they're also buying certain international territories. We are trying and negotiating to pull out France from that deal so we can sell it independently, and if we sell it independently, we're going to sell it to you.
So now I know the reason why Ford was so nonchalant in the previous meeting with the other French distributor. He doesn't need either of them for Dinosaurs. Or maybe he does. He doesn't know yet. Now it's off to the Ivy, a restaurant a few blocks away known for its Hollywood power lunches. Walking with Stuart Ford through the hotel and the area around the AFM is a little bit like being with a politician. All the while, he's shaking hands, patting backs, joking with acquaintances, and generally exuding a lot of charm. Lots of people seem to want to talk to Ford.
So, did the Reliance deal really up your profile at places like this?
Yeah, we were doing great as a company anyway, and we were sort of, you know, the prettiest girl in class, but then when you get basically
plugged into an $81 billion organization that everyone's perception changes. Hi, Uwe, how are you?
As we walk the three blocks to the Ivy, I revisit the meeting with Patrick from TF1 about walking with dinosaurs.
Well, look, everyone understands the rules of engagement up to a point, and you know the trick is to be as scrupulously fair with everybody as you can. Also, it's a competitive situation amongst the distribution companies, but by and large, they feel less slighted if the film's being bought by a major studio instead of one of their competitors. So,
right, they know it's in a different ocean,
exactly.
You know, pool.
So,
yeah.
In a relatively low-key way, that sort of gets me off the hook a little bit with him.
So who are we going to lunch with now?
We're going for lunch with a company called SND, which is a big distributor in France. For example, they distribute the Iron Man movies. They're affiliated to M6, the broadcaster, big, powerful buyer. They also have an offer on the table for Walking with Dinosaurs. And we'll play this one by ear.
At lunch, there's lots of joking and teasing. The IM Global guys, Ford, and two of his right-hand men are clearly friends with these French distributors. They're business associates who love to eat good food, drink good wine, and do good business. They debate how much Skyline will open to, and they differ on the value of the new Dread movie. Before coffee, Ford excuses himself, and we're off to a secret meeting at his hotel bungalow with a studio interested in buying Walking with Dinosaurs. During the long three-block walk, Stuart picks up the pace.
So, are you nervous? How are you feeling?
No. It's only a silly business deal.
I guess if you have all the other things in your back pocket, a big deal like this doesn't rattle you as much because you have the safety net of all the others.
Right. And this is what we do. It's something to not so much relish, but this is if you don't enjoy it, if you can't... If it's nerve-wracking, then you don't really want to be doing this stuff because it's not for the faint-hearted.
This is the one meeting I can't attend. It's too sensitive. I wait in the lobby of the Fairmont, and 20 minutes later, Ford emerges with his suit jacket off.
So you emerged with your jacket off. What does that mean?
It means it was hot in my room.
Now we're walking back to the Lowe's, and Ford is late for his next meeting. Over the next few hours, Ford's going to put on his banker hat.
David, how are you? Nice to see you.
He meets with financiers from Australia and others from Britain. And all the while, I notice that he's perfected the ability to check his BlackBerry without psychically leaving the room of the people he's with. Every once in a while, you hear this subtle little ding, and he's gotten a new email or text or something. He barely looks at it, but you know he's on top of it. By 5 o'clock, there's still no deal on Walking with Dinosaurs, and Ford can't go any further in the discussions until he's able to reach his partners in Mumbai later that night and his other partners in London in the morning. A few days later, it's announced that Fox has won the rights to Walking with Dinosaurs for the U.S. and many foreign territories. By some reports, it's the biggest deal in AFM history, and it was brokered in large part by Stuart Ford that day at the AFM. Now back at his office, I call him up to get the post-mortem. Ford can't discuss the details of the Fox deal, but needless to say, he's happy with it. I ask him if there's any anxieties now, like concerns about be careful what you wish for.
Well, the only anxiety one ever has is, okay, we've made all this noise. We've got, you know, a fantastic team of supporters for the film around the world. Now we have to make a great film, which is easier said than done.
For the business, this is Darby Maloney.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Matt Holzman is the executive producer. The theme music mashup was designed by beat architect Jason Groman. To leave a comment about today's show, email us at thebusiness@kcrw.org or go to kcrw.com/thebusiness, where you can also stream and podcast the show and check out past episodes. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. And now we're on Facebook as KCRW's The Business. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.